examination of his thoughts, a re-evaluation which led him to surrender. If it comes to that, Boguslavski went through the whole process in 8 days, during which, owing to my arrest, I recovered my balance and I was able to bring my still largely, if not utterly, criminal ideas in order which, though expressed suitably to the trial, amounts to the same thing. Thus it is not the case that good communists automatically obeyed when told the party needs your evidence, they did so after a varying length of imprisonment and interrogation. Even Bukharin himself, who is supposed to have been the main follower of this line, did not after all produce a confession wholly in accord with the prosecution's wishes, but chose to speak in such a way that anyone of any sense could see that the charges were false. And we have already noted that when Kaganovich, one of the keenest supporters of the purge, himself fell from power, he admitted to suggest that the party's image would be best served by bringing him to trial and blackening him as a spy, terrorist, and saboteur and shooting him amid public execration. On the contrary, he rang up Khrushchev and begged him not to allow them to deal with me as they dealt with people under Stalin, a grave dereliction from the point of view of service to the party. Clearly, without denying that in many cases the idea of being useful to the party was a component of the intellectual and psychological conditions of surrender, we can at least say that it took effect in combination with a good many other pressures. It is obvious enough that the oppositionists did not expect just fair treatment and political persuasion. Tomsky's suicide the day he heard of the charges against him is enough to show that, and his was not the only one. The political argument about service to the party can, in fact, be seen as a component in some cases, but not all, of a larger system of physical, intellectual, and moral pressures. In a case like Kamenev's, where the argument about the party's interests was combined with exhausting interrogation, heat, lack of food, threats to his family, and promises of his life, we can hardly expect to decide which played the most important part. For having gone into the habits of mind of the oppositionists who confessed, there are two major qualifications to add. First, as we have seen, not all the communists held the ideas of party unity and of self-abasement in the way that Zinoviev and Kamenev, Bukharin and Pyatakov did, and from them it was often impossible to obtain public confessions. We are told that Sirtsov, interrogated by the dreadful Vladzimirsky, signed nothing and that the same was true of Oglodov, Preberzhansky, Shliapnikov, Smilga, and others. And, second, public confessions were produced from non-communists, the doctors in the 1938 trial, most of the Polish underground leaders in 1945, the Bulgarian Protestant pastors in 1949. The motivations just described were of primary importance in the whole great cycle of party submission to Stalin, but in the trials themselves they were neither necessary nor sufficient causes of the particular surrender involved in public confession. In a number of the most important cases, they predisposed the leading accused to giving in to the pressures put on them, and they provided the rationale of the confessions made. But it was by the merely technical action of the NKVD interrogation system that these and other predisposing factors were brought to the full fruition of the scenes in the October Hall. Torture. When it came to explaining how the confessions had been obtained, the first thought of hostile critics was torture. Indeed, Khrushchev was to remark in 1956, "How is it possible that a person confesses to crimes which he has not committed? Only in one way, because of application of physical methods of pressuring him, tortures, bringing him to a state of unconsciousness, depriving him of his judgment, taking away his human dignity. In this manner were confessions acquired." The interrogation of the accused in the 1938 trial was started with a laconic memo from NKVD Deputy People's Commissar Frinovsky, "I authorize transfer to the Lefortovo. Beating permitted." And it is clear that Krestinsky, for example, was severely tortured. Physical torture had, of course, been in use since the early days of the regime. There are many reports of police brutality in the early 1930s. In Rostov, prisoners were hit in the stomach with a sandbag. This was sometimes fatal. A doctor would certify that a prisoner who had died of it had suffered from a malign tumor. Another interrogation method was the stoika. It consisted of standing a prisoner against a wall on tiptoe and making him hold that position for several hours. A day or two of this was said to be enough to break almost anyone. Other improvised torture methods included the swallow, which involved tying the hands and feet behind the back and hoisting the victim into the air. One prisoner describes having her fingers slammed in a door. Beating up was usual. Interrogators sometimes had to hand over prisoners to special heavily built thugs known to the prisoners as boxers, who would carry this out. Nor was this done only with peasants and socially hostile elements. A colonel, later restored to the party, reports being badly beaten up by the NKVD in 1935. There are many accounts of women being beaten. In general, the provincial interrogators were the more brutal. A Red Army choir accordionist had both legs broken at Khabarovsk, toenails were torn out at Baku, genitals beaten at Ashgabat. All this was, in a sense, unofficial. In most prisons, physical torture remains so. Needles, pincers, and so on are sporadically reported, and more specialized implements seem to have been in use at the Lefortovo. But on the whole, some appearance of spontaneity was maintained. Feet and fingers were stamped on. Broken off chair legs were the usual weapon for beatings, which were sometimes distinguished from torture. But as one very experienced prisoner says, this distinction was rather absurd when a man came back after such a beating with broken ribs, urinating blood for a week, or with a permanently injured spine and unable to walk. Physical torture, though not uncommon, had been contrary to regulations until 1937. Then it suddenly became the usual method of interrogation, at least in the bulk of cases at the lower level. The time of the Zinoviev trial saw the first official, though secret, permission to use any method put out on July 29, 1936. Early in the following year, an authorization from the Central Committee is, Stalin, was given to the NKVD. It was only on January 20, 1939 that a coded telegram formally confirming the system was circulated to the secretaries of provincial committees and Republican Central Committees of the party, and the heads of NKVD organizations. The Party Central Committee explains that application of methods of physical pressure in NKVD practice is permissible from 1937 on, in accordance with permission of the Party Central Committee. It is known that all bourgeois intelligence services use methods of physical influence against the representatives of the socialist proletariat and that they use them in their most scandalous forms. The question arises as to why the socialist intelligence service should be more humanitarian against the mad agents of the bourgeoisie, against the deadly enemies of the working class and of the collective farm workers. The Party Central Committee considers that physical pressure should still be used obligatorily, as an exception applicable to known and obstinate enemies of the people, as a method both justifiable and appropriate. This instruction has all the signs of being written by Stalin himself. He was, in fact, a great believer in physical methods. Khrushchev tells of his orders to beat, beat and beat again the accused in the 1952 doctor's plot. A recent Soviet article quotes from the archives a written note of his to Yazhov, when the old Bolshevik Bolobrodov was giving unsatisfactory testimony, "Can't this gentleman be made to tell of his dirty deeds? Where is he, in a prison or hotel?" A Soviet general describes his fate under this system. "I accidentally found out that my fiend of an interrogator's name was Stolbunsky. I don't know where he is now. If he is still alive, I hope he will read these lines and feel my contempt for him, not only now but when I was in his hands. But I think he knew this well enough." Apart from him, two brawny torturers took part in the interrogation. Even now my ears ring with the sound of Stolbunsky's evil voice hissing "Ull sign, ULL sign." As I was carried out, weak and covered in blood, I withstood the torture during the second bout of interrogation, but when the third started, how I longed to be able to die. Trademark. He adds that every one of his cellmates have confessed to imaginary crimes. Some had done this after physical coercion and others after having been terrified by accounts of the tortures used. Another report, by an old Bolshevik, says that only four of the 400-odd cellmates he met in prison had failed to confess, and the critic Ivanov Razumnik similarly writes that in his years in jail in Moscow and Leningrad only 12 of his 1,000-odd cellmates had held out. Registered in most cases, the threat of further torture was enough to prevent retraction. Various forms of humiliation were often especially effective on men weakened by torture. An army officer who withstood beating finally broke when the interrogator pushed his head into a spittoon brimful of spittle. Another gave way when an interrogator urinated on his head, an interrogation practice which according to reports became traditional. Moreover, when it came to those tried in open court, the defendants were warned that the tortures would be continued after the trial if they did not give the necessary testimony. The presence of their interrogators, who sat in front of them in court, would reinforce this. And, of course, confessions obtained by torture were useful in bringing pressure to bear on other victims. When Bukharin's first wife, Nadezhda Lukina, was interrogated, her brother Mikhail was among the members of the family who were tortured to give evidence against the others and her. A recent Soviet article gives a horrifying account of his withdrawing his evidence, and then, after further interrogation, confirming it again. The article quotes another former prisoner, a woman who, asking how could a brother give evidence against a sister, answered that a Comintern worker in her cell came back from interrogation one day, complaining bitterly that a close comrade had incriminated her. The examiners had shown her the testimony in his own handwriting. Soon afterward, she returned from a further session. This time she cried, "How could I? How could I? Today I had a confrontation with him and I saw not a man, but live raw meat." Yet in spite of Khrushchev's comment, torture is not a complete explanation when it comes to the public confessions of the oppositionists. We should record its extent, and its overwhelmingly powerful effects throughout the period. But critics were right in saying that torture alone could probably not have produced the public self-humiliation of a whole series of Stalin's enemies, when returned to health and given a platform. We shall see, in fact, that some accused withdrew in closed court confessions obtained by torture. Others insisted even in the preliminary investigation or in court that their statements charging violations of socialist legality be entered in the examination record. Equals. The conveyor. When there was time, the basic NKVD method for obtaining confessions and breaking the accused man was the conveyor continual interrogation by relays of police for hours and days on end. As with many phenomena of the Stalin period, it has the advantage that it could not easily be condemned by any simple principle. Clearly, it amounted to unfair pressure after a certain time and to actual physical torture later still, but when? No absolutely precise answer could be given. But at any rate, after even 12 hours, it is extremely uncomfortable. After a day, it becomes very hard. And after 2 or 3 days, the victim is actually physically poisoned by fatigue. It was as painful as any torture. In fact, we are told, though some prisoners had been known to resist torture, it was almost unheard of for the conveyor not to succeed if kept up long enough. 1 week is reported as enough to break almost anybody. Tilda, a description by a Soviet woman writer who experienced it, speaks of 7 days without sleep or food, the seventh standing up, ending in physical collapse. This was followed by a 5-day interrogation of a milder type, in which she was allowed 3 hours rest in her cell, though sleep was still forbidden. The conveyor and torture were not, of course, mutually exclusive. Recent Soviet accounts describe the actions of V. Boyarsky, still alive and in a post in a scientific commission. In the late 1930s, he served as interrogator in northern Ossetia, where he falsified accusations against 103 people, of whom 51 were shot and the remainder sent to camps, where most of them died. On one occasion, he interrogated a woman schoolteacher, Fatima Tagnieva, for 8 days, and then had her hung by her hair to a bracket on the wall, where she died. There is nothing new about the conveyor method. It was used on witches in Scotland. The philosopher Campanella, who withstood all other tortures during his interrogation in the 16th century, succumbed to lack of sleep. Hallucinations occur. Flies buzz about. Smoke seems to rise before the prisoner's eyes, and so on. Beck and Godon report a case in which interrogation lasted without any break for 11 days, during the last 4 of which the prisoner had to stand. Towards the end of even lesser periods, prisoners collapsed about every 20 minutes and had to be brought round with cold water or slaps. Sitting on a stool for 14 hours is, according to one victim, more painful than standing against a wall, where you can at least shift your weight from one foot to the other. The groin swells, and violent pains set in. In Weisberg's account of his interrogation, he mentions that on one occasion he was questioned for 18 hours, and then left locked in the washroom, where the floor was underwater. He was, however, able to lie down on a foot rack. After 14 hours, he was called out for a brief interrogation and sent back to find that the rack had been removed, so that he had to stand in an inch or so of water for 40 hours, until the next interrogation. Later, he was beaten up, under the new practice, but was then returned to the conveyor. A technical improvement had been made in that the seat had been taken out of the chair, and it was extremely painful, even briefly. There are very few accounts of successful resistance to the conveyor. One is of a 55-year-old anarchist, Eisenberg, who on being called a counter-revolutionary refused to answer any more questions. Beating up had no effect on him, and he survived a conveyor lasting for 31 days, an extraordinary record. Examination by a doctor showed that though he was physically very sound, there was something abnormal about his imperviousness to pain. He is supposed to have been sent to a lunatic asylum. Weisberg himself held out for 7 days, helped by a brief interruption, but finally confessed. After a day's rest, he withdrew the confession. Interrogation started again. This time he gave way on the 4th day, having already told the examiners that every confession he made he would withdraw when he recovered. The 3rd conveyor session ended on the 5th day without his signing a fresh confession, though by now the interrogators had 2 documents. And here we have the defect of the conveyor. Although it was almost always successful, and usually in 2 to 3 days, it has no essential advantage over torture proper, with which it was often combined, since the confessions it produced could be withdrawn. The long interrogation. The interrogation system, which broke down many prisoners to the extent of maintaining their confessions at public trial, was conceived on rather different lines. It aimed at a more gradual, but more complete, destruction of the will to resist. With intellectuals and politicians, the process often lasted a long time, some, with interruptions, up to 2.5 years. The average is thought to have been about 4 or 5 months. Throughout the period, the prisoner was kept with inadequate sleep, in cells either too hot or, most usually, too cold, on insufficient though attractively prepared food. The Spanish communist general El Campesino speaks of 3.5 ounces of black bread and some soup served beautifully and tastily twice a day, with results such as scurvy, which must be taken as planned. Physical exhaustion produces increased liability to psychological disorders, a well-established phenomenon noted in the Second World War in, for example, boats' crews who had drifted for a long time, even persons whose stability was such that they were not likely to break down under the most difficult situations frequently then succumbed. Interrogation usually took place at night and with the accused just roused, often only 15 minutes after going to sleep. The glaring lights at the interrogation had a disorientating effect. There was a continual emphasis on the absolute powerlessness of the victim. The interrogators, or so it usually seemed, could go on indefinitely. Thus the struggle seemed a losing one. The continual repetition of a series of questions is also invariably reported to disorient both semantically and as regards the recollection or interpretation of facts. And there was a total lack of privacy. A Pole, Z. Stypulkowski, who experienced the whole process in 1945, describes it. Cold, hunger, the bright light and especially sleeplessness. The cold is not terrific. But when the victim is weakened by hunger and by sleeplessness, then the 6 or 7 degrees above freezing point make him tremble all the time. During the night I had only one blanket. After 2 or 3 weeks, I was in a semi-conscious state. After 50 or 60 interrogations with cold and hunger and almost no sleep, a man becomes like an automaton. His eyes are bright. His legs swollen, his hands trembling. In this state he is often convinced he is guilty. He estimated that most of his fellow accused had reached this condition between the 40th and underscore 70th interrogations. International considerations made it necessary to bring the Polish underground leaders to trial before Stypulkowski, alone among the accused, was ready to confess. We have also had the evidence of men who made a full confession, Artur London and, more revealingly, Evzen Lobel, sentenced to life imprisonment in the Czechoslovak Slonsky trial in 1952. Lobel mentions other prisoners being beaten, having their genitals crushed, being put into ice-cold water, and having their heads wrapped in wet cold cloth, which, when it dried, shrank and caused unbearable pain. But, unlike London, he was not tortured himself and confirms that torture was inadequate for the preparation of the victim of a set-piece trial, when the whole of the person had to be broken. He describes having to be on his feet 18 hours a day, 16 of which were devoted to interrogation. During the 6-hour sleep period, the warder pounded on the door every 10 minutes, upon which he had to jump to attention and report. Detainee number 1473 reports, strength 1 detainee, everything in order. He was, that is, awakened 30 or 40 times a night. If the banging did not wake him, a kick from the warder would. After 2 or 3 weeks, his feet were swollen and every inch of his body ached at the slightest touch, even washing became a torture. He says that the worst pain came in his legs when he lay down. He was taken 6 or 7 times to what he was led to believe would be his execution. He did not mind it at the time, but the reaction afterwards affected him badly. Like others in various Eastern European trials, he is convinced that he was given drugs. But if so, this was a late refinement and does not appear in reports of pre-war interrogations in Russia. Loeb notes, incidentally, that the doctor's brutality was even greater than that of the interrogators. He finally reached the stage where it did not occur to him to repudiate his confession. Having confessed, he was allowed books, adequate food, and rest, but he had, as he puts it, been deprived of his ego. I was quite a normal person, only I was no longer a person. A manual for NKVD workers was written on orders from Yazhov by 3 of the most notorious inquisitors, Vladzimirsky, Ushakov, and Schwarzman, and approved by Beria after Yazhov's fall. It contained no overt call for torture, but a few quotations from it, given recently in the Soviet press, are worth recording. Investigations at the NKVD are carried out according to the Code of Criminal Procedure. But the grounds for initiating a criminal case are somewhat broader. The accused must not be allowed to get the better of you. During the investigation, the accused must be kept strictly in line. Failure to confirm the evidence, already obtained, is indicative of poor work by the interrogators. 2. There is no doubt that not only non-political defendants, but even strong political opponents can be broken by the Azhov method. In this connection, the statements of the Bulgarian Protestant pastors in their February 1949 trial are the most relevant, since no one could possibly argue that loyalty to party or creed induced them. In their confessions, they all remarked that they now saw communist rule of their country in a new light. In their final pleas, Pastor Naumov thanked the police for their kindness and consideration and said, "I have sinned against my people and against the whole world. This is my resurrection." Pastor Dybkov was in tears as he admitted his guilt and said, "Do not make of me a useless martyr by giving me the death sentence. Help me to become a useful citizen and a hero of the Fatherland Front." Pastor Bezlov, who had earlier stated that he had read 12,000 pages of Marxist literature while in prison and that this had entirely changed his outlook, declared, "I have now an intellectual appreciation of what the new life means and I want to play my part in it." In his speech to the United Nations General Assembly on October 26, 1953, Dr. Mayo drew attention to the parallel between the similar treatment of the American prisoners of war in Korea to obtain confessions of germ warfare in the work of Pavlov in establishing conditioned reflexes in dogs. Soviet psychologists and physiologists always treated Pavlov as the basis of their work, and his method of associating stimuli to provide an automatic response accords with the reduction of prisoners to the point at which they associate survival with a single response of accepting what their captors tell them. In a human being, this involves considerable degradation. An animal's response, at least to situations which it recognizes, the only ones it can cope with, is in principle unconditional and without discrimination. Man's higher status consists precisely in his ability to distinguish and discriminate. To put it another way, among men it is only the psychotic who gives an unconditional reaction to a stimulus. But a man, even in this state, is not an animal. He needs at least the appearance of rational motives. In the case of communists, as we have seen, this was ready to hand in their party principles. A survivor of the 1949 purges in Hungary describes how László Reich, after severe torture, regarded service to the party as a golden bridge back to his self-respect. There were other pressures. Hostages. There is no doubt that threats to the family, the use, that is, of hostages for good behavior, was one of the most powerful of all Stalin's safeguards. It seems a general rule that with confessions by prominent figures, members of the family were in the power of the NKVD. Bukharin, Rykov, and Zinoviev all had children of whom they were very fond, whereas at least some of those tried in private, such as Kara Khan, did not. Several of the accused in their final pleas referred to their children, for example, Kamenev and Rosengoltz. Engineers under arrest as early as 1930 had been threatened with reprisals against their wives and children. And the decree of April 7, 1935, which extended full adult penalties down to children of 12, was a terrible threat to those oppositionists with children. If Stalin could openly and publicly declare such an atrocity, they could be sure that he would not hesitate to apply the death penalty secretly to their own children in cases where he thought it would bring him advantage. According to Orlov, it became regular practice, on Yazhov's orders, for interrogators to have a copy of the decree on their desks. We are also told that fear of reprisals was made more dramatic and emotionally effective by the display on the interrogator's desk of private belongings of members of the family. Even if accepted and allowed for on the conscious level, this must have been a continual argument in the unconscious in favor of surrender. The use of relatives as hostages, and their imprisonment or execution in other cases, was a new development in Russian history. In Tsarist times, revolutionaries never had this problem. Here again, Stalin recognized no limits. Moreover, it was not merely a matter of threats to relatives' lives. They tortured husbands in front of wives and vice versa. Again, Roy Medvedev tells us that Kosyr stood up under torture, and was only broken when his 16-year-old daughter was brought to the interrogation room and raped in front of him. On the other side of the coin, it was suggested, even at the time, that there was something about the confessions which was specifically Russian. The Dostoevsky-style habit of self-abasement was much spoken of. Bukharin denied that the Almay slave had any bearing on the confessions. He was himself a more intellectual and in a sense more westernized character than many of the leaders. But in any case, these adumbrations of national psychology are very vague and in themselves unconvincing. It is not surprising that at the time people faced with the extraordinary phenomenon of the confessions should have sought out extraordinary explanations. Nevertheless, like any other, the Russian culture has its own characteristics, affecting the attitudes of all those brought up in it. We can hardly quite exclude some effect of a tradition of self-immolation, even though the Russian tradition also contains famous examples of most outright defiance or authority, as with Archpriest Aikum, who spat in the face of the Tsar. Another powerful motive was that of self-preservation. This is a paradox which confused observers in the West, and still confuses some. By the full and sometimes abject confession of capital crimes, it appeared that the defendants were actively seeking the death sentence, which, they themselves sometimes said, they fully deserved. The reality was different. The absolutely certain way for a defendant to get himself shot was to refuse to plead guilty. He would then not go before an open court at all, but either perish under the rigors of the preliminary investigation, or be shot, like Ruzatak, after a 20-minute closed trial. The logic of Stalin's courts was different from what is customary elsewhere. The only chance of avoiding death was to admit to everything, and to put the worst possible construction on all one's activities. It is true that even this seldom saved a man's life. But it did sometimes, for a while, as in the cases of Rodick, Sokolnikov, and Rakovsky. At the August 1936 trial, moreover, the defendants had actually been promised their lives and had reasonable expectation that the promise would be fulfilled. The same promise was evidently made to Pyatakov and others in the second trial. It must have lost a good deal of its efficacy, yet, even then, it represented the only possible hope. Besides, on the face of it, the Pyatakov situation was different. While Zinoviev and Kamenev had continued in effect to oppose the Stalin leadership, and had long since been excluded from decent party society, Pyatakov had been of the greatest service to the dictator and had been admitted by him to his latest Central Committee. He was, in addition, under the apparently powerful protection of Orjonikidze. And a little hope goes a long way. Promises that confessions in court would save their lives continued to be made to various groups of accused, for example, the generals in the Tukhachevsky case. As to communist motives proper, the party and the old opposition had already been smeared beyond relief. Even for a man like Sokolnikov, it may have appeared that no action he could take could affect the issue one way or the other, and that the only consideration left was to attempt to save his family. So much more admirable, then, is the sense of truth and personal courage shown by men like Ryutin, who even under the pressure of such arguments seem to have died in silence. For when everything is said of the pressures for confession, it is remarkable how many did not give way or, if they did, were not trusted to maintain their confessions in court. Non-confessors were a special breed. Kessler analyzes his friend Alexander Weisberg. What enabled him to hold out where others broke down was a special mixture of just those character traits which survival in such a situation requires. A great physical and mental resilience, that jack-in-the-box quality which allows quick recuperation and apparently endless comebacks, both physical and mental. An extraordinary presence of mind. A certain thick-skinnedness and good-natured insensitivity, coupled with an almost entirely extroverted disposition. Notice the absence in Dr. Weisberg's book of any contemplative passage, of any trace of religious or mystic experience which is otherwise almost inevitably present in solitary confinement. An irresponsible optimism and smug complacency in hair-raising situations, that it can't happen to me attitude, which is the most reliable source of courage, and an inexhaustible sense of humor. Finally, that relentless manner of persisting in an argument and continuing it for hours, days or weeks, which I mentioned before. It drove his inquisitors nuts, as it sometimes had his friends. Similar attitudes can be seen in other known non-confessors, for example, the Spaniard El Campesino. We can trace the tough temperaments elsewhere. In Pervouralsk, in 1938, the chief construction engineer at the Novotruby plant, who had been in prison for 13 months, little more than a skeleton in rags and with patches of blood and bruises all over him, was interrogated by the local NKVD chief, Parshin. He was accused of having put wooden roofs over furnaces, which might well have caught fire. He continued to explain that though the roofs should have been made of iron, a government order signed by Orjonikidze had ordered wood because of the iron shortage. To several similar questions, he answered in the same way. Similar accounts are given all through the literature, though they are always treated as most exceptional. As we have noted, only about 1 in 100 failed to confess. It is significant that many oppositionists who had repudiated the buckler in view of party discipline in the early 1930s did not come to trial. Stalin must have wanted Ryutin in the dock, but he did not get him. The same no doubt applies to Aglanov, Sirtsov, A. P. Smymov, and the others who tried to organize resistance while the right leaders were counseling patients. The absence in their makeups of the party fetishism noted in Bukharin, Zinoviev, and most of the other public confessors must be a factor. It is fairly clear that neither the pressures nor the arguments were enough to break many or, in other cases, to keep them broken. Just as a number of prominent accused were not brought to trial with Slonsky in Prague because they would not behave in court, of 50 or 60 leading functionaries available, only 14 were used. According to most reports, There were several hundred candidates for the Moscow trials, but only about 70 actually came into court. Of those named for complicity in the Zinoviev trial, 16 appeared at the time, 3 committed suicide, and 7 were tried later. 43 others were never brought to trial and so never made public confessions. They included men as prominent as Oglanov, Shliapnikov, and Smilga. At least 22 of them must have been dropped at a fairly late stage. For the dossiers quoted from the preliminary investigation are numbered intermittently from 1 to 38. In the Pyatakov trial, where dossiers ran from 1 to 36, there are 19 missing. The leading figures have the low numbers: Pyatakov, 1, Rodik, 5, Sokolnikov, 8, Drobnys, 13. Serebrakov and Miralov do not happen to be quoted, but even inserting their names, there are clearly missing volumes, and the presumption is that they existed and covered figures at this political level not brought to trial. This presumably includes those shot in secret a couple of weeks earlier, among them Ryutin and Smilga. The idea of confession. The question naturally arises, not only why the accused made the confessions, but also why the prosecution wanted them. In the public trials, indeed, as Rodik pointed out in the doc, there was no other evidence. A case in which there was no evidence against the accused, who denied the charges, would clearly be rather a weak one by any standards. In fact, confession is the logical thing to go for when the accused are not guilty and there is no genuine evidence. For in these circumstances, it is difficult to make people appear guilty unless they themselves admit it. And it is easier to stage manage a trial of this sort if one can be sure that no awkward defendant is going to speak up at unpredictable intervals. In general, moreover, in the public trials of Zinoviev and the others, the confession method can be easily accounted for. Stalin wanted not merely to kill his old opponents, but to destroy them morally and politically. It would have been difficult simply to announce the secret execution of Zinoviev. It would have been equally difficult to try him publicly, without any evidence, on charges which he could vigorously and effectively deny. Even if confessions seem highly implausible, they may have some effect on skeptics, on the principles that there is no smoke without fire and that mud sticks. Even if the confession is disbelieved, a defendant who humbly confesses and admits that his opponents were right is to some extent discredited politically, certainly more than if, publicly, he had put up a stout fight. Even if the confession is disbelieved, it is striking demonstration of the power of the state over its opponents. It is more in accordance with totalitarian ideologies that a defendant should confess, even under duress. It is better discipline and a good example to all ranks. Those who would not confess properly in court were sometimes provided with posthumous confessions, to keep up the standards, as with the Bulgarian Kostov in 1949. These are rational considerations. But it is also clear that the principle of confession in all cases, even from ordinary victims tried in secret, was insisted on. In fact, the major effort of the whole vast police organization throughout the country went into obtaining such confessions. When we read, in cases of no particular importance, and ones never to be made public, of the use of the conveyor system tying down team after team of police investigators for days on end, the impression one gets is not simply of vicious cruelty, but of insane preoccupation with a pointless formality. The accused could perfectly well, it seems, had been shot or sentenced without this frightful rigmarole. But the extraordinary, contorted legalism of the whole operation remained to the end. It would have been possible simply to have deported thousands or millions of people on suspicion. Yet perhaps 100,000 examiners and other officials spent months interrogating and guarding prisoners who did not, during that time, even provide the state with any labor. One explanation advanced in the prisons was that, apart from a hypocritical wish to preserve the facade, the absence of confessions would have made it much more difficult to find fresh inculpations. It is also clear that the confession system, involving one single type of evidence, was easier to stereotype down the whole line of investigators than were more substantial methods of faking. When evidence of actual objects was involved, there was often trouble. In the Ukraine, a group of socialist revolutionaries confessed to having a secret arms cache, at the instance of an inexperienced interrogator. The first conspirator confessed to having put it in charge of another man. The second man, under torture, said that he had passed the weapons on to another member. They went through 11 hands until, after a discussion in his cell, the last consignee was urged to think of someone who had died whom he knew well. He could only remember his former geography master, a completely non-political character who had just died, but maintained that the examiner would never believe him to have been a conspirator. He was finally persuaded that all the examiner wanted was to get rid of the arms somehow, so he made the confession as suggested, and the examiner was so delighted that he gave him a good meal and some tobacco. We may also feel that with the establishment of the confession principle in the public trials, its abandonment with lesser accused might have been taken in NKVD usage as an implied criticism of the trials. The principle had become established that a confession was the best result obtainable. Those who could obtain it were to be considered successful operatives, and a poor NKVD operative had a short life expectancy. Beyond all this, one forms the impression of a determination to break the idea of the truth, to impose on everyone the acceptance of official falsehood. In fact, over and above the rational motives for the extraction of confession, one seems to sense an almost metaphysical preference for it. As early as 1918, Dzerzhinsky had remarked, of enemies of the Soviet government, when confronted with evidence, criminals in almost every case confess, and what argument can have greater weight than a criminal's own confession? Vyshinsky was the great theorist of confession. He regarded a confession, however obtained, as in itself grounds for a conviction, and recommended prosecutors and investigators to make a practice of getting the defendant's testimony in his own handwriting, as looking more voluntary. He added, "I personally prefer a half confession in the defendant's own handwriting to a full confession in the investigator's writing, thereby, as a recent Soviet legal commentator remarks, creating the appearance of the voluntary nature of this testimony." Tilda, one prisoner reports that after several days of bullying and beating to make him sign a confession which he had not read, with the interrogator showing especial rage at his obstinacy, he found himself unable to speak or use his hand, whereupon the interrogator put a pen in his fingers and signed it thus. Vyshinsky's remark is interesting, as showing some awareness on the part of Stalin's entourage of the basic incredibility likely to attach to confessions. But as to their general desirability, we can note that Vyshinsky was not a man likely to intrude his own prejudices in a matter in which Stalin was deeply concerned. We can take it that basically the idea must have been Stalin's own. It involved endless thousands of men and women and days and months of mental and physical torment. Book 2. The Azhov Years. For the truth cannot be hid. Somebody chose their pain. What needn't have happened did. W. H. Auden. Last stand. Singleness of purpose became with him duplicity of action. Karl Marx on Ivan III. Autumn maneuvers. The Zinoviev trial, and particularly the executions, severely shook the officer corps of the party, those elements who, until recently, had considered themselves the sole possessors of the right to occupy themselves with politics. Everything had been arranged without consulting them. Nothing could now be done about the dead. A dangerous precedent had been successfully established. Preparations for the next round were already at hand. N. I. Mirilov, former Inspector General of the Red Army, had been arrested on April 17, 1936. He had previously been working in Western Siberia. On 5 and 6 August, two more ex-Trotskyites from the same area, Y. Androvnys and M. S. Boguslavsky, were pulled in. These were distinguished old revolutionaries of the second rank. Drobnys, a worker, a shoemaker, an active revolutionary at the age of 15 who had served 6 years in a Tsarist prison, had survived three death sentences. From one of these, when captured and wounded by the whites during the Civil War, he had escaped by a rare chance. He had later been a secretary of the Ukrainian Central Committee. The giant Mirilov came from a poor toiling family and had joined workers' circles in 1899 and the party in 1905.2. He had had an extraordinary Civil War record. Boguslavsky, too, was a veteran of both the underground and the Civil War. We have already noted the arrests of the more important figures of Sokolnikov, 26 August, and Serebrakov, 17 or 18 August, who were under interrogation soon after. Sokolnikov was already confessing, though vaguely, in August. And as Vyshinsky had said in his statement of 21 August, Bulkarin, Rykov, Pyatakov, Rodik, and Uglanov were to be the subject of further investigation, with Tomsky, who had, however, escaped by suicide. On 27 August, 2 days after the executions, most of the members of the Politburo were in Moscow, including the Kiev-based Kosyur and Postyshev. On the last day of the month, Molotov returned from leave. Apart from Mikoyan, the only full member not there was Stalin himself, who was still holidaying at Sochi, where he was to remain for several weeks. Yazhov, however, was in Moscow, and doubtless in touch with his superior. Bukharin now wrote letters to the members of the Politburo and to Vyshinsky protesting his innocence, and followed them up on 1 September with a letter to Voroshilov in more personal terms, approving the executions and saying that perhaps even Tomsky had become involved with the opposition. Voroshilov answered curtly on 3 September, returning the letter and referring to Bukharin's disgusting attacks on the party leadership. Bukharin then wrote to him again, defending himself at some length, but got no reply. Over the next week or so, the party leadership discussed the cases of the newly incriminated, and the revulsion felt seems to have shown itself in opposition to further persecution. To question the guilt of Zinoviev and Kamenev, or the conduct of the case, was now impossible, for they were proven traitors. But with Bukharin and Rykov, it was different. Moreover, they were popular in the country and in the party in a way that Zinoviev and company had never been. And the suicide of Tomsky had evidently been a severe shock. On September 8, 1936, Bukharin and Rykov were brought to a confrontation with Sokolnikov in the presence of Kaganovich, Yezhov, and Vyshinsky. Sokolnikov repeated the charges, but said he had no direct evidence and had heard of the rightist involvement only from Kamenev. When the guards removed Sokolnikov, Kaganovich said to Bukharin that the testimony was all lies and that Bukharin should go back to his editorial offices and work tranquilly. On 10 September, in a small paragraph at the top of page 2, Pravda announced that the investigation into the charges against Rykov and Bukharin was being dropped, for lack of evidence. This reversal is said to have been made under pressure of some members of the Politburo. Politically, the exculpation is understandable. From a judicial point of view, it is fantastic. The accused in the Zinoviev case had been sentenced to execution on their own evidence against themselves. But their evidence against Rykov and Bukharin was of exactly the same status, neither more nor less credible. It might be thought that this alone would have shown Western observers the meaninglessness of the whole trial. Moreover, though the case against the two rightists was suspended, it was not found necessary to make amends to their colleague Tomsky. Article 107 of the Criminal Code of the RSFSR laid down penalties for provoking suicide by moral or physical persecution. It was not applied. It is improbable that a majority against the purge now existed in the Politburo. Voroshilov, Kaganovich, and probably Andreev were by now committed to it. Molotov, too, must already have learned his lesson. At least, he was back in good odor by 21 September, when an alleged attempt on his life was being put into the scenario for the next trial. And this return to favor can hardly be accounted for except on the view that he had aligned himself wholeheartedly with Stalin's plans in the September discussions. Nevertheless, Stalin retreated as far as the two rightists were concerned. He had, it should be noted, never committed himself finally to their arrest. He may well have intended no more at this stage than a preliminary sounding, a putting of the Bukharin problem on the agenda, as it were, in his usual devious style. In that case, it was not a question of decisive votes in the Supreme Body. And in his absence, his own prestige was not directly involved. As I write in 1989, there is still some uncertainty about the plenums of the Central Committee which took place in the last half of 1936, but were never announced. For many years, the only reference to any in an official document came in evidence at a later trial referring to one of the autumn plenums of the Central Committee of the party, which, from the context, must have been after March 1936 and before 1937. Roy Medvedev writes of one of the plenary sessions held in the late summer or early autumn of 1936, at which the arrest of Pyatakov, and apparently of Sokolnikov, was sanctioned. As to late summer, one former official has described a four-day plenum held in early September, with the Bukharin issue debated on the last day. But this is hard to reconcile with the absence of various leaders, and it shows signs of confusion with later plenums. Moreover, we are told that a plenum discussed the Bukharin issue for the first time in December. The December plenum, described as unofficial, was only confirmed in 1988. If the other was convened in early autumn, it was presumably in late September or October. As for the constitutional point, this does not, after all, help us with this plenum's dating. Khrushchev remarks that the Central Committee members arrested in 1937 and 1938 were expelled from the party illegally through gross violation of the party statutes, since the question of their expulsion was never studied at a Central Committee plenary session. By implication, the arrests of Pyatakov and Sokolnikov, the only Central Committee member and candidate member known to have been arrested in 1936, were legalized. But we are now told that this was not done, as Khrushchev implies, by a plenum. Instead, the Central Committee was polled on 25-26 August in the case of Sokolnikov, and on 10-11 September in the case of Pyatakov. The plenum, when it assembled, was presumably required to vote formal approval. It was quite a different matter, as yet, from proceeding against men like Kamenev and Zinoviev, already in jail, already expelled from the party. Stalin had made certain gains. The materials were in his hand for prolonging the purge. He now had, after all, a reasonable quota for the next trial, Serebrakov and Sokolnikov, and now Radek, arrested on 22 September, and Pyatakov, who had been taken on 12 September, while Sokolnikov, though not Serebrakov, was already confessing. The failure over Bukharin and Rykov, even if Stalin had not been certain of success at the first attempt, evidently rankled. It was plain that a powerful effort, a new campaign, would be needed. In the Black Sea sunshine, he considered the next move. The Soviet press concerned itself with other matters: democracy, the triumph of Soviet aviation, the successful harvest, and massive support for the struggle of the Spanish Republic. Like a general who transfers the weight of his offensive from a line where the going is heavy to an easier approach, Stalin shifted his attack to Yagoda. Yagoda's position at that time remained something of a mystery. It is clear that he was involved in the preparations for the 1936 trial from the start, though perhaps excluded from the key discussions and conversations preceding the case. He is indeed said to have urged that the case be discussed in the Politburo. At the same time, it seems that he was himself deceived by Stalin's assurance that Zinoviev and Kamenev would not be executed. He was later to be accused of shielding Ion Smirnov, though there was an obvious motive here, in that this was advanced as an explanation for Smirnov's unsatisfactory behavior in the dock. Nevertheless, it does seem that Yagoda may have made some attempt to temper the wind to the oppositionists. He was to be similarly accused of ordering that Oglanov's testimony be kept within certain limits. And there are other reports of underground obstruction within the NKVD which took the form of framing questions in such a way as to protect those interrogated. The most likely occasion for the development of more definite resistance on Yagoda's part would be following the executions. This could only have manifested itself in the discussions about the fates of Bukharin and Rykov. We can be sure that Yazhov, who was to replace Yagoda, offered stronger resistance to clearing the rightists. He seems to have acquiesced very reluctantly in the decision. He regarded the rehabilitation of Bukharin and Rykov as temporary, vowing that he would yet make good the mistake, and he and Agranov almost immediately started accusing Yagoda of laxness. For the moment, Bukharin and Rykov were safe. The former continued to hold his position as editor of Izvestia, and both remained candidate members of the Central Committee. It was clear that some leaders hoped that the momentum of the purge would peter out with the forthcoming Pyatakov case. But if Stalin could not obtain the support he needed in the highest party bodies, he had other methods of gaining his ends. He proceeded to the coup which was to bring the terror to its most frightful climax, the appointment of Yazhov as People's Commissar for Internal Affairs. On 25 September, Stalin and Zhdanov sent a telegram from Sochi to Kaganovich, Molotov, and other members of the Political Bureau. "We deem it absolutely necessary and urgent that Comrade Yazhov be nominated to the post of People's Commissar for Internal Affairs." Yagoda had definitely proved himself to be incapable of unmasking the Trotskyite, Zinovievite bloc. The OGPU is 4 years behind in this matter. This is noted by all party workers and by the majority of the representatives of the NKVD. The 4 years is significant and sinister. It was 4 years almost to the day since the September session of 1932 which had blocked the attempt to execute Ryutin. It has since been suggested that the phrase might refer to the 4 years passed after meetings and connections between Trotsky's son and Soviet sympathizers, and the alleged formation of the Trotskyite, Zinovievite bloc, in 1932. But the chief offender, Ion Smirnov, had been arrested within weeks, and since 1934 the NKVD had been finishing off Trotskyites and Zinovievites by the score, so could hardly have been said to have fallen behind 4 years. The point is hardly a crucial one. But in fact it was now that Ryutin was brought back to the Lubyanka from an isolator and his interrogation began. On 4 November, he was signing a categorical refusal to confess to terrorism. It seems certain that Stalin proposed to use him in the next show trial, but despite illegal methods he remained recalcitrant. No one, of course, thought for a moment that Yagoda's removal indicated mere incapability. It was at once noted in the party that it was not a question of dissatisfaction with his insufficiently active work. This indicated political distrust of him. The transfer of Yazhov to duties that he was already much concerned with in any case could hardly have been the occasion for members of the Politburo to oppose the General Secretary, even if Orjonikidze, Chubar, or Kosyr might have wished this. Although the tone and the intention of the new appointment would be obvious, as a practical measure it would be hard to argue against. The following day, Molotov carried out instructions. The shift was used to rid the Soviet government of Rykov. Next day, the papers announced Rykov's release, without the conventional comment that he was going to other work, the appointment of Yagoda to Rykov's post of People's Commissar of Communications, and Yazhov's appointment as head of the NKVD. On September 29, 1936, and again on October 21, 1936, circulars were issued from the Central Committee. They called in effect for the end of unfair expulsions from the party and a stepping up of fair ones. They were followed by press censures of a number of local leaders for failure in one or another of these respects. On 29 September, too, a secret directive, drafted by Kaganovich, accepted by the Politburo, and signed by Stalin, called for settling with the Trotskyite, Zinovievites, including not only those arrested whose interrogation was complete, and those like Miralov, Pyatakov, and Belobrovtsov, whose investigation had not yet ended, but also those who were earlier exiled. That is to say, Ryutin and others who had never been Trotskyites or Zinovievites. Yagoda handed over his office on September 30, 1936. On the same day, the announcement of M.D. Berman as deputy head of the NKVD was made, while Yagoda's second deputy, G.E. Prokofiev, was transferred with him. On 17 October, a more sinister figure still, the puffy-faced M.P. Frinovsky, was also appointed a deputy head of the NKVD, and on 3 November, L.N. Belsky. Neither Berman nor Frinovsky nor Belsky had been serving in the old secret police apparatus proper. Berman had headed the labor camp administration, Gulag, Frinovsky commanded the frontier guards, while Belsky was head of the militia. Otherwise, the old NKVD chiefs were not yet disturbed. Even Yagoda's personal assistant remained in the NKVD for some time. Molchanov and the other departmental chiefs kept their posts, though Yazhov brought in his own man from the Central Committee apparatus to help them in their work, and to learn how to supplant them. A team of more than 25 interrogators headed by Agranov started to prepare the new trial. The original script for this described Pyatakov and his fellow accused simply as a reserve center which had plotted but not acted. By this means, the case was represented as less serious than that of August, and one not implying the death penalty. It was no doubt partly by this means that Stalin had gained the leadership's consent to go forward with the Pyatakov case, which, it might be hoped, would be no more than a tidying up of loose ends in a fairly restrained fashion. But after the NKVD had proceeded on these lines for a few weeks, the line suddenly changed. Molchanov, in Yazhov's presence, instructed a meeting of interrogators that a new line of investigation was to be pursued. The accused were to be required to confess that they had plotted to seize power and had worked with the Nazis for this purpose. Stalin had not, since Radek's recantation in the 1920s, had anything to complain about from him. He had betrayed Trotsky's emissary, Blyankin, who as a result was shot in 1929. In early September 1936, Radek wanted to remind the General Secretary of these services in exposing Trotskyites, but feared that if he himself wrote to Stalin, his message would be intercepted by the NKVD. So he had asked Bukharin to write to Stalin about it if he himself were arrested. Radek was one man who had truly burned his bridges to the opposition. At the same time, he was nowhere regarded as a serious politician, and there was no question of his ever competing for even the lowest rung of power. What Stalin's motive was in bringing Radek in particular into the plot at all is obscure. It may simply be that until he could secure the arrest of the rightists, he was rather low on big names for another trial. And Radek was at least a very well-known man. So Sokolnikov seems to have had an interview with Stalin and to have been promised his life. It is not clear why Sokolnikov believed this promise. It was, in all probability, made before the execution of Zinoviev and his followers. But Sokolnikov seems to have been convinced of its efficacy even after the executions. But in any case, he had little choice. He had a young wife and a son by a previous marriage who was in his twenties. Sokolnikov was brought to a confrontation with Radek immediately after the latter's arrest. This did not lead to anything at once. Radek was worked on the conveyor system by Kedrov and other interrogators. At first he resisted stubbornly. The sacrifice of Pyatakov is perhaps the clearest sign of Stalin's motives. He had been, it was true, an oppositionist, and an important one. But he had abandoned opposition in 1928 and had worked with complete loyalty ever since. He was regarded by the Trotskyites as a deserter. Trotsky's son Sadov, chancing to meet him on the Unter den Linden, had publicly insulted him. He had not liked, but he had honestly accepted, Stalin's leadership. There was, in his case, no real question, as might have been thought of Zinoviev and Kamenev, and of Bukharin, of any desire to present an alternative leadership. And his services to Stalin's government were extremely valuable. His energy and intelligence, probably unrivaled in the whole leadership, had been channeled into carrying out Stalin's industrialization plans. What was there to be said against him? He had loyally accepted the Stalin leadership, but he would have accepted an alternative leadership if Stalin could have been overthrown. He supported him with reservations. He had been a major critic of Stalin's in the 1920s. He had made it clear that he regarded his rise to power as unfortunate. Above all, he was even now, whatever his own desires, leadership timber. Lenin had named him among the six most important figures in the party. Of them all, Stalin was to allow none but himself to survive. He had even been thought of as an alternative prime minister to Lenin in the left communist plans of 1918. Orjonikidze, as People's Commissar for Heavy Industry, depended entirely on the genius of Pyatakov, and was generous enough to admit this. Pyatakov's was the brain and the driving force behind the plan, creating a major industrial base against all the handicaps that resulted from Stalin's system, the wastages due to the purges of experts, the establishment of impossible prestige targets, and the suspicions and inefficiencies of administrators. There is a report that after Pyatakov's arrest, but before its announcement, the director of a scientific institute who knew of it made a public attack on him in Orjonikidze's presence. Orjonikidze interrupted him with the remark, "It is very easy to attack a man who is not there to defend himself. Wait till Yuri Leonidovich returns." But Pyatakov broke down comparatively quickly. In 33 days, Radek held out for 2 months and 18 days, Serebrakov for 3 months and 16 days, Muralov for 7 months and 17 days. We have already noted the extravagance of Pyatakov's earlier submission to the party. When he was incriminated in August 1936, Yazhov had told him that he was being demoted to a post in the Urals. He denied the terrorist charges, Yazhov reported, but said that he deserved demotion for not having denounced his ex-wife's connections with Trotskyites. To regain the trust of the party, he would be willing to appear for the prosecution at a trial, and would personally offer to shoot all the accused, including his ex-wife, and announce this publicly. Yazhov said that this was absurd. Pyatakov then wrote to Stalin, denying the accusations and saying that he would die for the party and Stalin. He was to have his wish, but not yet. Saboteurs in Siberia. One theme already well established in Soviet mythology, that of sabotage, had not been raised in the Zinoviev trial. It would have been difficult, in fact, to charge men who were all either in prison or cut off from major work with such acts. Anybody can commit assassination, but sabotage is carried out by industrialists and engineers or, anyhow, people with access to the relevant machines. Almost all those in the group now coming to trial had held, until shortly before their arrests, posts as people's commissars, assistant people's commissars, leaders of industrial complexes, engineers, and so forth. And to show that no breach in tradition was intended, they were specifically linked with the saboteurs of the earlier period. The concept of sabotage as a political weapon is in general an absurd one. The very word, with its implications of peasants throwing clogs into machinery, is a fair description of what is almost invariably an individual and illiterate protest. The only real exception is to be found in large underground movements in occupied countries in time of war, operating with the sympathy of most of the population. In those circumstances, on the one hand, it becomes possible on a fairly wide scale, and on the other, it becomes, or at least appears to be, a genuine contribution to the defeat of the enemy. In peacetime, a small conspiracy could scarcely hope to achieve any political result whatever by such means. In any case, plotters working to remove the political leadership by terror would hardly dissipate their forces, or run the extra risk of discovery, for local and indecisive actions of this type. Nor had any previous conspiracy of the sort ever done so. The illogic of the accusations was not the sort of consideration to stop Stalin, and over the following years sabotage became the theme of a mass purge at all levels. The official definition of sabotage was now extended, and the penalties for it were made more severe. On November 29, 1936, Vyshinsky ordered that within a month all criminal cases of major conflagrations, accidents and output of poor quality products be reviewed and studied with the aim of exposing a counter-revolutionary and saboteur background in them and making the guilty parties more heavily liable. In the new industrial region of the Upper Obi Basin, the Kuzbas, almost 2,000 miles east of Moscow, a number of reconstructed Trotskyites held posts suitable to their condition. The great plants had gone up, amid a squalor for the workers, mainly deportees, which the old industrial revolutions in the capitalist West had not matched. At the same time, unrelenting pressure for results at all costs had led to the virtual abandonment of the usual sort of safety precautions. Frightful accidents were common. On September 23, 1936, there was an explosion in the Tsentralnaya mine at Kemerovo. Its director, Noskov, and several of his subordinates were at once arrested. His superior, Norkin, head of the Kemerovo Combined Works Construction Trust since 1932, was arrested on 30th of September. For the NKVD this was a most useful line of responsibility, as Norkin was an immediate link with Drobny's and, through him, with Muralov. A whole Trotskyite nest in West Siberia, operating moreover under the direct orders of the Deputy People's Commissar for Heavy Industry, Pyatakov, was thus laid open to easy attack. To make it yet easier, the NKVD ordered its representative in the Kemerovo industrial area, Shestov, to accept the role of accomplice. It was thus possible to establish the idea of widespread sabotage before Pyatakov.